Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, the Mary Poppins of disinformation is gone, and the Disinformation Governance Board under the Department of Homeland Security is paused.
Sure it is.
But the work continues, so said KJP in response to a query from Steve Ducey yesterday, or Peter Ducey, you know, the kid.
So if it's pausing because you think the board was mischaracterized, then the disinformation board is being shut down because of disinformation? Is that what's happening here?
Look, I mean, the board was put forth for a purpose, right? To make sure that we really did really did address what was happening across the country when it came to disinformation.
And it's okay it's to all, wait now,
but no, it's just going. It's going to pause. There's been a mischaracterizations from outside forces, and so now what we're going to do is we're going to pause it, and we're going to do an assessment. But the work doesn't stop. We're still going to continue the work. The DHS is still going to continue.
What does that mean? The work doesn't stop. What work are they going to continue? So the disinformation board was sidelined by disinformation. That was nice phrasing by
good?
Peter Ducey.
Yeah.
And Karine Jean-Pierre is continuing to struggle making sense of those talking points in front of her. Now, just so we know what we're talking about with respect to the executive director that was retained after what was undoubtedly an exhaustive search, Nina Jankowicz, the Mary Poppins of misinformation, that's not our nickname for her. Remember, that's her nickname for her.
Oh, yeah, she sings.
Othering is really quite ferocious. It's when a huckster takes some lies and makes them sound precocious by saying them in Congress or a mainstream outlet. So disinformation's origins are slightly less atrocious. It's how you hide a little, hide a little lie. It's how you hide a little, hide a little lie. It's how you hide a little, hide a little lie. When Rudy Giuliani shared bad intel from Ukraine, or when TikTok influencers say COVID can cause pain, they're laundering disinfo when we really should take note and not support their lies with our wallet, voice, or vote. Oh, information laundering is really quite ferocious. It's when a huckster takes some lies and makes them sound precocious by saying them in Congress or a mainstream outlet. So disinformation's origin seems slightly less atrocious.
I mean, I thought that was a joke at first when I saw that, and no, Justin here's like, no, that's true.
She's having fun. She really is passionate about misinformation and disinformation and malinformation and all the bastardizations of information. One of the reasons that she ultimately had to resign as executive director, as you just heard, is because she's out of her mind.
She's crazy. And apparently, according to, you know, the Washington Post, she did resign. She wrote a letter of resignation and then was reportedly given the option to stay on as an evaluation of the
gone.
Board.
So, yeah. The process is fascinating.
And it's gone. Not paused. The program's going to dissolve.
And this was a purveyor of misinformation that was, of course, retained to be the arbiter of misinformation and disinformation. We documented some of this. The Wall Street Journal reminds us in their editorial, the ad tech industry should stop placing ads for masks and worse, straight up disinfo !! On articles and info about coronavirus. That was in March of 2020 when masks were dismissed shortly before they were required, you remember. She said Hunter Biden's laptop should be seen as a Trump campaign product, classic Russian disinformation. She tweeted the conspiracy theory that Trump had not one but two secret email servers to communicate with an influential Russian bank. Unbelievable, her quotes. So it's another case where the, as the Journal opines, the disinformation doctor needs to heal thyself. And it also reminds us of the question that's operative when you talk about the ministry of truth here and the real world incarnations of, you know, Orwellian dystopia. So who monitors the monitors? You want to place this sort of power under the auspices of the Department of Homeland Security, and you want to put it in that person's hands effectively, or frankly, that person's hands with Ali Mayorkas as the oversight? Maybe not. Something else that's interesting about this, and about her, Nina Jankowicz, the criticism from the left. I know Taylor Lorenz stopped the waterworks long enough to decry this as Jankowicz and the Misinformation Governance Board being derailed by the right. That ignores some problems that the left had with Ms. Jankowicz as a propagator of disinformation. I refer you to a piece in The Nation, which is a left-wing rag, by Lev Golenkin. This is from April. This is just from a few days ago, before the word came down, though, that she was going to be gone and this was going to be put on pause. Nina Jankowicz is a veteran information warrior, but her experience, in quotation mark, working with StopFake should have set off alarm bells. StopFake, U.S. government-funded anti-disinformation organization that was founded in March of 2014 and lauded as a model of how to combat Kremlin lies. 4 years later, StopFake began aggressively whitewashing two Ukrainian neo-Nazi groups with a long track record of violence, including war crimes. Today, StopFake is an official Facebook fact-checking partner, which is a whole other area of concern, the non-governmental censors and who they're allied with, who monitors those monitors. Now we know StopFake, or we are reminded that StopFake is a fact-checking partner of Facebook. That should give additional pause and expand the conversation. StopFake, founded in right after Ukraine's 2014 Maidan uprising, which ousted Poroshenko and put in Zelensky. It was formed by professors and students from Kyiv, Mohyla Journalism School. StopFake presented itself, again reading from the Nation piece, left wing. StopFake presented itself as a plucky grassroots group wielding hard facts and semi-permanent smirks as it shredded Russian propaganda. Western reporters and checkbooks were paying attention. Shortly after its creation, it began receiving funding from Western governments, National Endowment for Democracy, which is mainly funded by Congress, the British Embassy in Ukraine, George Soros' Open Society Foundation. And among StopFake's hosts was Jankowicz, a graduate of Bryn Mawr and the Georgetown School of Foreign Service. I should have known she went to Bryn Mawr. On January 29th, she hosted a StopFake episode, whose lead story dealt with a perennial obsession of Russian propaganda, Ukraine's volunteer battalions. There are dozens of paramilitaries formed in 2014, among dozens, to fight against Russian-backed separatists in the Donbass region. At the time, Russian press was bristling at Kyiv's creating a new holiday to honor military volunteers, including those who were affiliated with some of these paramilitary groups, most notably the Azov Battalion, that is a outright neo-Nazi organization. Here's what she said, suggesting, or in response to this idea that there were problems with who some of these paramilitary organizations were and what they have done, the crimes, the war crimes. Volunteer battalions organized throughout the country, and they supported weak Ukrainian armed forces, prevented further Russian separatist encroachment. The volunteer movement in Ukraine extends far beyond military service. Volunteer groups are active in supporting Ukraine's military with food, clothing, medicine, and post-battle rehabilitation, as well as working actively with the nearly 2 million internal refugees displaced by the war in Ukraine. This is Jankowicz. She extolled the battalions with an on-screen graphic displaying the patches of the four paramilitaries, including the Azov Battalion. All four, this author, The Nation, recounts, have a documented record of war crimes, while Azov is an outright neo-Nazi group. And he goes into more detail about the different paramilitary groups and what they're accused of doing in the context of war, the fighting in eastern Ukraine. And so here we go. It's not just the domestic politics where she was just another in the chorus of left-wing propagandists when it came to Hunter Biden's laptop or when it came to Russian collusion, but also professionally with this Stop Fake organization, she was whitewashing the activities and the nature of entities in Ukraine that, you know, we're now indirectly funding through taxpayer largesse to fight the incursion by the Russians.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. And Mayorkas, he was on Meet the Press, and he said, you know, he conceded that the department didn't do a good job of communicating the exact mission of the Disinformation Governance Board. You know, he said, quote, it's we could have done a better job of communicating what it is and what it isn't.
Right.
Well, why it's even have it?
He just said it. You know, basically, this is what they always say when something that is structurally unsound or runs afoul of the Constitution, I would argue.
But this woman's not a serious person.
That's what they always say. It's a marketing problem. It's not a substantive problem. It's not a policy mistake. It's not a governmental overreach. It's just a marketing problem.
But she's not a serious person. I mean, after she posted that Mary Poppins of Disinformation song you just heard, then she went, I had two on-camera interviews today, and I still have a full face of makeup. What should I make a TikTok about? I mean,
John,
just juvenile
Naperville
behavior. Embarrassing.
Does anybody but myself find it ironic that the Committee on Disinformation was derailed by what the White House is labeling misinformation?
Yeah, no. Clearly Peter Ducey did. This is why he asked the question. Thanks for the call, John.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. America First with Sebastian Gorka. Today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4. On AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, turning our attention to the governor's race in Illinois, the Republican primary, since there is no primary against Jelly Belly. This story from the Chicago Tribune, you don't know who my boyfriend is, he's the mayor of Aurora.
Ruh-roh.
This recounts a police-involved action.
Last November, right?
This is, last year, apparently Richard Irvin's girlfriend, or one of them, depending on who you believe.
The paper said it hurt his then-girlfriend, but whatever.
Mm-hmm. Miss Ayella Clark, and I understand she owns like a furniture store or something in town. Maybe those in the know in Aurora can
help us out.
Give us additional context.
312-642-5600.
She was arrested for striking a security guard at a marijuana store after she got upset because the ATM at the marijuana store didn't work. And told her to contact the ATM owner. It's not their ATM. And she waited around for an hour. And then they said, well, you got to go. And then she wouldn't leave, and the security officer tried to escort her out, and then she kicked the security officer. And then she said, I'm not going anywhere until my boyfriend gets here. You don't know who my boyfriend is. He's the mayor of Aurora.
And she's trying to get out $100, you know, to get her fix on, you know, at the marijuana store. And, she wouldn't leave for one. She stayed there for an hour. What, she thinks staring at the machine is going to make the money pop out? And on the way out, no, she kicked the security guard in the leg and then struck her in the abdomen before the guard pepper sprayed her in the face, according to the report. And then police arrived.
Yeah, that's not the interesting part. Of course, the interesting part is when Richard Irvin arrived, the mayor of
exactly.
Aurora. And this happened in Aurora. And he told her, so according to the police report, that the charges would go away. And according to the police report, she was in his car and he was talking on a Bluetooth, talking to someone else, saying the charges will go away, not to her. He characterizes that, oh, I just meant that I'm going to get you an attorney and you'll be represented in court. And then, you know, the attorney will make the charges go away through the judicial process.
Mm. He told the Tribune, I told her specifically not to argue or have any conversations with the police about it and that it would be handled in court. That's what he claimed.
Yeah.
When they brought this report to his attention.
Quoting the police report, her boyfriend called someone via Bluetooth within the vehicle, stated the charges, and relayed to the person on the other end of the phone that the, quote, charges would be taken care of, unquote.
Now, she claims, she stated, the girlfriend, Ayala Clark, that she said, quote, that the security guard put hands on her first. Yeah.
Don't care. Okay. It's irrelevant. What's relevant is whether or not Aurora Mayor Richard Irvin interceded on behalf of one of his girlfriends. Was he married at the time? Put his finger on the scales of justice in favor of one of his girlfriends.
But who dates somebody like this? I mean, honestly, that says a lot about his character that he's even involved with a woman like this.
Well, I don't think.
And I know crazy. So
I don't think you want to go down the road of saying a lot of things about his character. You know, what this speaks of, and there's more to it. I've worked in cesspools before. I've worked in the Illinois Republican Party circles. Of course I have. I've worked in the town of Cicero.
Don't forget Rosemont.
I've worked in cesspools before, so I know a little something about these cultures. And everything I know about Aurora under Richard Irvin smacks of cesspool, smacks of somebody who leverages his office for a certain lifestyle, who wields his power on behalf of friends or girlfriends and against political enemies, who is always on the make and perhaps on the take. And this is why you see so much political promiscuity from Richard Irvin. Another story about another Richard Irvin girlfriend.
Oh, there's more. Can I say one more thing about Ayala Clark, though? According to the security guard who didn't want to be interviewed in the paper, she repeatedly said, I'm going to call my boyfriend, and you don't know who my boyfriend is. He's going to close you guys down for doing all of this and not giving me my money back. So she's felt a little entitled there, don't you think?
When Irvin said he's going to make the charges go away to somebody he was talking to on the phone with his girlfriend in the car, do you think that's what he meant, that I'm going to get you an attorney? By the way, he's an attorney. By the way, he's done criminal defense work. Do you think that's what he was saying?
No, but he's also reappointed Ayala Clark to the city's Hispanic Heritage Advisory Board, which advises the city on matters involving the Hispanic community. Plans and events and things.
Tonya Curry recounted last month an interaction she had with another Richard Irvin girlfriend. Somebody that he was a law partner with, somebody that ran for Kane County judge. Brittany Michelle Peterson is her name. She is the mother of twins that she had with Richard Irvin.
Oh, boy.
Wedlock.
Really?
She recounts this story, does Tonya Curry. She posted it publicly, so it's not private communication here. I'm very forgiving of people's behavior, but I can't let this one go. I met Kane County judicial candidate Brittany Michelle Peterson tonight while having dinner. Without knowing who I was, she proceeded to tell me that she was Richard Irvin's baby mama. What?
Oh, boy.
I'm quoting Curry's post. How she hates all Republicans and many other derogatory comments. After she shared way more than I asked for or wanted, she took and ate food off my husband's plate. Curry continued, I've never been so offended, so embarrassed, and so disappointed in another human being, let alone someone running for judge. Where's the honorable demeanor? Where's the common decency? Where's the discretion? To all my Kane County friends, please do not vote for this woman, whether you're a Republican or Democrat. She will embarrass and disappoint you if given the opportunity to sit on the bench and decide the fate of other people's futures. She ran in 2020. She was backed by Richard Irvin. Of course she was. She lost. Partner, as I said, Peterson and Irvin LTD. The Irvin is Richard Irvin. More of Richard. By the way, she was also rated, not recommended, in that race in 2020 by the Illinois State Bar Association.
That speaks volumes.
It also speaks volumes. Now you can say, well, this is just Tonya Curry, who I know I supported when she ran for legislative office. This is just sour grapes from Tonya Curry. She's probably just making this up, right? Because Richard Irvin endorsed Karina Villa, a Democrat, against Tonya Curry, the conservative Republican, in 2018, which also, regardless if you think that factors in, I don't. I think Tonya Curry is telling the truth.
So do I.
But in addition to that, it's a reminder, Richard Irvin, the conservative Republican, so he says, running for governor, the Republican nomination for governor, endorsed Democrats like Karina Villa for state legislative office over Republicans. So tell me again about how Jim Durkin and the House Republican caucus is so interested in winning races. They're so interested in taking a majority. They're so interested in beating Pritzker. They have such a passion for the policy agenda they want to pursue if they were given the chance to govern. This is all part of, well, combine politics, the cesspool that is Illinois politics generally, a deeper part of the cesspool that exists in Aurora, particularly under the current mayor, Richard Irvin, endorsing Democrats, whatever is happening in his personal life, which anybody you talk to in Aurora who knows anything is, there's a lot of questions that would be raised under examination about his personal life. I know people don't care about things like character, but I'm just saying this is where one's personal life bleeds over into one's public life or professional life when you let it. And Richard Irvin seems to have repeatedly let it over and over again. But you want to entrust him, well, the surrender GOP established, want to nominate him to be the leader of the Republican Party, and you think this is a person who not only can defeat Pritzker, you, the combine Republicans out there, that cannot, and the ignoramuses who aren't paying attention, you think this is somebody who can beat Pritzker, and you think this is somebody who is going to lead Illinois' comeback from financial and moral oblivion? I mean, who are you kidding? This is not a close call.
I'm surprised. Didn't Ken Griffin, didn't he, dig deep into his past before giving him $45 million?
Richard Irvin was at the Downers Grove Township Republican Organization, CONFAB, yesterday.
Did he take questions?
He didn't. It was, everybody got their turn at the wheel speak. But on his way out the door, Jeannie Ives tried to ask him a question, simple question. And this was captured.
Good.
This was captured at the event. So this is how that exchange, Jeannie Ives asking Richard Irvin a simple question about who he voted for. And again, if your knee-jerk reaction is say it doesn't matter who he voted for president, Clinton or Trump, Biden or Trump, well, just remember, this is a guy who's spending tens of millions of dollars of Ken Griffin's money telling you lies about other people's voting records and suggesting that they're not real Republicans because of an alleged vote or because of a mischaracterization of a vote in the case of Darren Bailey. And so you don't get to lob those grenades without taking incoming fire on the same.
It's Jeannie. How you doing?
Oh, my.
Hey, listen, I just want to know, did you vote for Clinton or did you vote for Trump? Did you vote for Trump? But will you answer yes or no? Did you vote for Clinton or Trump? Because you're accusing opponents.
Hold on a second, Jeannie. Hold on a second, Jeannie.
Wait a minute.
I'm Republican. I always vote Republican.
Okay, but did you vote for Trump? That's the question, because you won't answer it. You accuse your... You accuse your opponents of voting for them, but you won't say yes. So yes, you voted for Trump. If you're a Republican, so yes, you voted for Trump. Is that right? So you voted for Trump then, right? Richard, come on. You're telling this to other opponents, and you won't answer the question. You won't answer the question. Okay, so that's what you get. I mean, how do you? This is such a dishonest campaign. It's beneath you.
It's not, the only thing I disagree with is it's not beneath him. No. That's who he is. That's who he has demonstrated himself to be repeatedly. And by the way, I always vote Republican. That's coming from a guy who voted in 7 of the last 8 Democrat primaries.
I was telling people about him last night, and I mentioned that fact. And they're like, oh, really? And so trying to get people to wake up and see that this guy is a flim-flam man. I tried to talk to him. He was chucking and jiving and running away. Good for Jeannie.
Yesterday, there was another confab with the candidates. That was before the Daily Herald editorial board, that august body. God, what a waste of time. But anyway, it was an opportunity for the candidates to appear on Zoom together. And this is something Darren Bailey offered in the direction of Richard Irvin.
Your messaging, sir, is the exact same thing that I fought 4 years ago. The lies and the attacks, they're different mailers. You can't tell the truth about yourself, and you sure as heck can't tell the truth about anybody else, period.
It's like you know how to tell a lie, we lie yourself.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right. That's a good summation on Richard Irvin. He can't tell the truth about himself or anybody else. And so the remedy is to tell the truth about Richard Irvin. Larry in Elmhurst.
Hey, good morning. Hey, none of these clowns have even mentioned that Pritzker spent, I think it was $42 billion to pay off state bills from COVID money he got from the feds.
Yeah.
So. But I'm just saying, none of these clowns, as much as they want to be governor, have even mentioned a word about that.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call, Larry. Well, you did have one of the candidates sue Pritzker over COVID policies.
Right.
With respect to why aren't they? Well, you got a 5-way primary, Larry. You have to jump off one bridge before you can jump off the next one. So, running against Pritzker should be baseline, except in the case of Richard Irvin, who has Pritzker come to town for vaccination events where he praises him as a great and compassionate leader. That's what you should be paying attention to, Larry from Elmhurst, not pro forma statements opposing so much of what Pritzker has done over the last 4 years. That's what you're going to get from every Republican nominee. Even disingenuously, you're going to get that. The question is, who can you believe, Larry from Elmhurst, when they say something critical of Pritzker's policy choices? Who can you believe? Do you get it? How long do you have to live in Illinois before it penetrates the concrete? It's a Republican primary. Standard bearer for the party. Who is best and most credible to take the fight to Pritzker and the Democrat socialists in charge of the state? Clowns, Larry? There's a lot of clowns in the Illinois Republican primary electorate, too, it turns out. Vincent St. Charles.
Good morning, guys. Yeah, like Amy said, didn't they vet this guy? Didn't they look deep before this Griffin gave money to this guy? I mean, he's a joke, but he fits in perfectly with Illinois politics, I must say.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but we can change it, and we have the power to.
Well, we can change it
in
now.
Less than
if he gets
2 months.
People are going to vote for this guy, I think. It's kind of scary.
I mean, the first thing I heard about Richard Irvin from my friend in Aurora was that, oof, wait till they get a hold of his girlfriends. I said, what do you mean? Like, he traipses women in and out of here all the time.
Frank, Arlington Heights.
You know, the Democrats were in the political wilderness in this state for 26 years, 1976 until 2002. That appears to be if Richard Irvin wins. what the Republicans will be in this state. He is going to lose worse than Rauner did. I don't see how he gets any conservatives to vote for him. I won't. I'll just sit home. Mm-hmm. I'll deal with another 4 years of Pritzker. I have no intention of voting for someone who has voted in 7 Democratic primaries out of 8, or whatever number of cycles that is. Zero intention of voting for him. And I know many, many people who feel the same way. So good luck, Republicans. You're gonna break the Democratic record of 26 years in a row.
We're not there yet. I mean, there's still hope.
Oh, there's no question. It's a toss-up. I mean, it's a toss-up right now. So you can absolutely affect the outcome come June 28th.
Right. So let's not jump the, you know.
No, you're right. Absolutely. You should not assume the race is over because he's got the most money. There's the political graveyard is littered with candidates who had the most money and didn't get the most votes. But that is the operative question. Are you going to have a plurality of Republican primary voters welcome another Trojan horse into the city? I mean, how many Trojan horses do you usher in until you start to express some skepticism about what you're being fed from the same people? Well, that's a question we're going to answer in the next 5 weeks.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Cause they got the beat, the campus beat, the campus beat. Yeah, the campus beat.
The next pandemic is mental illness, writes Dan Henninger in the Wall Street Journal. And this relates to our Campus Beat segment because we'll hear some perspectives from college students in the Future View column that the Wall Street Journal routinely runs, which is really good. Thoughtful responses from college students that span the viewpoints on a particular issue, and the issue du jour this week, mental illness. Henninger writes, it's funny because we were talking with that Duke University professor yesterday about long COVID, her concerns about long COVID, and she was talking about them physically. What about mentally and emotionally? Henninger writes, the politics, science, and economics of mental health are difficult. If you want to do X, say compel treatment for psychosis, an organized resistance will try to stop you, and it's expensive. So the politicians give up and invoke guns, racism, and the rest, as we've seen this week in the wake of the Buffalo supermarket shooting. Mental disorder has become too pervasive to sweep under a rug as big as the entire United States. The solution has been to let mom and dad alone pick up the pieces. It's not enough. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. Be interested in your perspectives on your kids, or and that could be young people too, young adults, mental health, and whether or not within their social circles you're seeing the spikes that seem to be reflected in the macro data in this country, like 108,000 overdose deaths last year.
Yeah, don't know any kids that died from COVID, but I know one that accidentally overdosed and one that committed suicide.
Well, the other thing is you can see some of it, too. Mentally ill homeless, as Henninger writes, piling up on the streets of San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York, Austin, and on and on.
In Chicago, I mean, every day there's new tents popping up. You guys should drive along Lakeshore Drive, head north from Irving Park, and you're going to be amazed. And now people are living in their cars and, you know, have tarps over it, and they don't tow the cars. They're lining up on Ravenswood there.
We have suicide as the second leading cause of death for people 15 to 34, and that increased by 15% during the pandemic. And so we can talk about these mass shooting incidents, and as Henninger reminds us, where signals were missed, as they were missed in Parkland, as they were missed in Virginia Tech, and focus in on law enforcement and focus in on parents, but part of the focus needs to be mental illness, which is exacerbated during the pandemic, as all of the data seems to indicate. College students' perspective on this. Gen Z discussing the rise in depression and anxiety. There's a few here. Jesse Hagee, Bates College, Environmental Studies, talking about the retreat to social media. Interactions on social media cannot replace real-life communications. Young people are often struggling to figure out who they are regardless of social media. When missing the social life of school, they can begin to feel empty. Eventually, if this emptiness is not filled by a return to in-person interactions, young people rely more and more on social media, which will sustain us only for a limited time before the addiction takes over, addiction to social media, and causes harm. Something that we actually were talking about pre-pandemic, right? About yep. screen time and social media and the studies about addiction, you know, the dopamine hits that that kids get addicted to, and then the hurt that they suffer when they're not getting the hits or they're being ridiculed or ostracized in these social media communities.
Seen parties they weren't invited to. But we worked so hard as parents to get our kids off screens. And then, boom, it was all screens all the time from 2019 of March all the way into what we had 12 days of in-person learning in 2020. Screens constantly from 7:30 in the morning or 8 o'clock until 3 o'clock. And then they had to do their homework online. And then if they were in group, you know, if they had IB, they had to do Zoom with groups because they couldn't meet in person. It was constant screens.
Zachary Mason, he's a electrical and computer engineering major at Carnegie Mellon. He also raises the specter of social media, but he also points to another cultural change. He said, it's unfortunate to see people who feel alone turn to social media as an escape when it provides only a temporary cover. The root cause of the loneliness, I think, is a decline in religious engagement. From a psychological perspective, religion provides a purpose for one's life, which leads to greater fulfillment. Without that, it's easy to become nihilistic and think life is futile. Forming deep relationships and filling the religious void are potential remedies to my generation's mental health struggles. Interesting. What do you think about what Zach Mason has to say? He might be over the target. Joshua Gamariello, University of Tennessee, business administration major. One thing I attribute to feelings of purposelessness is over-reliance on technology, including the oversaturation of entertainment and the resulting lack of personal initiative to gain skills and develop passions. The anxious awareness that notifications could ping our phones at any moment makes it all the more difficult to be in the here and now, which increases anxiety and dissatisfaction. If we're to address the growing mental health issue, each of us needs to learn to be independent of technology and control when we use it. We need to realize the importance of passions and the danger of the overuse of entertainment. Chris in Barrington, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Well, good morning. Happy Thursday. We got to quit blaming this on the China virus. We got to blame it on the reaction to the China virus. My kids go to Barrington, and we were fighting for many, many, many months to get these kids back in school. We were telling these people the whole time about all the mental problems that are going to come with this and all the other stuff, but they did not listen, and they kept up with the same losing, tactic. And it's what we get, you know. It's what we voted for. It's what we get. It's how these people handle the situation. That's what made it so bad. I don't know anybody that died from the China virus.
Thanks for the call, Chris. The numbers, a million people now have died from COVID or COVID-related illness, whatever. I don't want to get into discounting the number or whatever the number is. But bottom line is, you know, we're not dismissing that.
But they punished the wrong age group, the elderly and with compromised autoimmune systems. Those people should have stayed inside. Well, and let the kids live and live a normal life.
It wasn't about punishing anybody. It shouldn't punish is not the response to this. So nobody should have been punished.
It was a punishing act, I thought, to lock down kids and lock them out of schools. Yes,
and Dan Henninger makes this point, too. We're going to have another pandemic. What we can't have is another Tony Fauci. It's literally what he says in his column.
Good.
And so, of course, we're talking about the response to this. But now the question is picking up the pieces, because that's what you're charged to do, both individually as adults and as a family with respect to kids. And so you're trying to get a handle on where we're at with this. And Henninger makes the point, too, on the mental illness side. You know, we've the deinstitutionalization of mental health patients that began in the 70s. And have we come up with a acceptable or successful post-institutional model? Not to say there weren't abuses, and with the warehousing of mental illness patients is without without problems or controversy. It clearly is not. The question is, are we addressing the problem more effectively now versus then? Or are we addressing the problem just more effectively enough in general? Do we have the focus correct? And when you have politicians demagoguing inanimate objects and people based on their political philosophy, clearly that is not going to do much to address the mental health of people who are in crisis, is it? And that's what we have. And we can play that game, and we can, you know, I can deconstruct all these loony op-eds from the left blaming Tucker Carlson, one in the Washington Post suggesting that the Buffalo supermarket shooter has the same ideology as the conservative members of the Supreme Court. I mean, it's so nonsensical, it's not worth the time. But this is worth the time, talking about what is our public policy in this area. And how could it be more effective? Because even the questions that we ask about who knew what when, and of course you start with the parents and the larger family of anybody who commits an atrocity like was committed in Buffalo. But as Henninger makes the point, you know, just saying, hey, it's up to the parents, well, that's not enough. We saw that, and blaming the parents, sometimes there is more blame than other times. Sometimes you can look and say, well, this is something that sort of defies common sense in terms of a response. And other times there isn't.
Just reminds me of Jared Loughner. You know, he shot Gabby Giffords and killed somebody in Tucson. His parents knew he was mentally ill. His professors at Pima Community College knew. And yet he was still able to buy weapons, and the parents didn't stop him.
And again, it's something that is sometimes easier said than done, isn't it?
Right.
In addition to that, it's also, what are we espousing? What are we suggesting to young people is important? Well, mostly their identity, mostly their race and their genitalia, and how they identify their gender is what we're telling them is important, at least in certain quarters. But which is why I'm sort of encouraged by what some of these college students offer to the Wall Street Journal. Another one, Andrew Kent, who's a chemistry major at University of Georgia. One factor in particular has shown a strong correlation to mental decline in America's youth: secularization. Religious practice in the U.S. has been on decline for some time now, in parallel with an ever-increasing mental health crisis. We cannot simply say that one causes the other because they happen simultaneously. We can examine the logical connection between the two, which could potentially support a cause and effect relationship. Purpose is at the core of human existence and therefore of human happiness. And where is purpose found? The kind of questions you can take the time to think about in college. Where is purpose found? For thousands of years, people of all different tribes and tongues have found purpose in religion. Religion yields an existential hope for the future that extends beyond the boundary of death. Even when life is difficult, there's a promise that it isn't a waste. Secularization douses this hope, reducing it to ashes. So how many people are promoting the importance of faith and thinking, and necessarily a component of that, as Mr. Ken so eloquently articulates, the idea of, to borrow from Rick Warren, a purpose-driven life. I don't hear that a lot. I certainly don't hear from those who have camera time in public office. You hear it, you read it on some op-ed pages or in the Future View column at the Wall Street Journal. But how much of it is pointing the way to a more productive place for young people, as opposed to just the counseling and the, which is mainly done by the secular left, the counseling profession, mainly the secular left, drugs. You know, it's a drug solution. It's a counseling solution at the hands of the secular left. How am I supposed to think of myself? As he asked, where do I find my purpose? Mom, dad, coach, teacher, a faith figure. That's the question that so many young people are searching for an answer to. And so what's the answer that you provide them? Maybe that's where the conversation should go, rather than talking about purposeless assault weapon bans and demagoguing race, forcing this through the partisan political prism. Dan Henninger definitely advances the flag with his column, and hopefully people will give that some consideration. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Before we talk gas prices, just a response to that, another disingenuous, dishonest campaign ad from Richard Irvin that you just heard during the break about the DGA, the Democrat Governors Association, running ads. Yeah. Darren Bailey obviously does not control the ad budget for the Democrat Governors Association. So the idea that he's folding in with the Democrats because the DGA is running ads attacking Irvin because they're under the same misimpression that the Democrats masquerading as Republicans in this state are under, that are behind Irvin, that he's the best chance to be Pritzker. So what? So that's their misunderstanding of the political landscape. These are the same people who thought that Donald Trump would be the best nominee to go up against Hillary Clinton in 2016. Because the only Republican who couldn't beat Hillary Clinton was Donald Trump. And it turned out probably the only Republican who could have beaten Hillary Clinton that year was Donald Trump.
Yeah.
So because the Democrat Governors Association thinks something, that doesn't make it true. You would think Republicans would know that. But no, not here. And so then not only do they not understand it, then they mischaracterize what the DGA is doing when they go after Richard Irvin, according to Richard Irvin, work to advance the nomination of Darren Bailey because they think Darren Bailey would be the easier candidate to tackle than Richard Irvin was. First of all, that's not the case, because elections are about contrast, not imitation, which is what Irvin provides, imitation. And so I just want you to understand that. And then the dishonesty of suggesting, implying that this is some collusion between Bailey and the Democrat Governors Association. How ridiculous. As I said when we tackled the governor's race last hour, how many times are Republicans in this state going to fall for the Trojan horse or push the Trojan horse inside the gates of the party? You have some people that are duped welcoming it, and you have other people that are actually pushing it that are part of the conspiracy, that are part of the undermining of the party from within. Enemies inside the perimeter. Okay. On this matter of gas prices, J.P. Morgan is projecting that gas prices will surpass $6 a gallon by August.
Which, as you mentioned, will be $8 then. Because right now, driving in, $5.88 for regular unleaded.
$4.56 per gallon is the national average. That's another record, according to AAA. It's above $6 already in places like L.A. and San Francisco. And as you just mentioned, Chicago's not far behind, in part because of our double taxation on gas at the state level.
And it doesn't, it's not any better in the suburbs.
And here is what Jennifer Granholm had to say at the Politico Sustainability Summit.
Did I miss that one again this year? Darn it. I had a dress picked out for it.
Yeah, I'm sure that was a regal affair. Here's Granholm suggesting what the Biden administration is going to do about it. Doesn't sound like much.
What we need to do, the strategy that will work best, is to reduce demand by moving to electrification.
Oh, yeah. That's...
And that's why the whole the holistic strategy that the president has put forward, which is to try to do as much as we can with the biggest tool we have, which is the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, to increase supply now as other supplies coming online, and at the same time, accelerate this move to electric.
Mm-hmm. So, in other words, go buy a Tesla.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Interesting.
But we can't afford to buy a Tesla or a Prius, anything right now.
Yeah, well, especially because...
car prices are up 38%.
Especially because those on the lower end of the socioeconomic scale are getting hit the hardest by inflation. Mm-hmm. This out of the UK, they saw consumer price inflation click at about 9% in April. But they also looked past just that aggregate number and tried to break it down of who's experiencing inflation the worst. What the Brits find is that the poorish British households experiencing the largest price increases. According to the Institute for Fiscal Studies, the 30% of households in the UK with the lowest incomes saw the prices they pay rise by at least 9.7%, as high as 10.9%. The top 10% of earners saw their prices rise by 7.9%. The reason that people at different income levels spend different proportions of their earnings on different goods and services. And so the consumption baskets are different and the associated prices are different, and thus the overall hit that people are taking. So here again, the great vanguard of those strivers at the lower end of the socioeconomic scale is or socioeconomic ladder is kicking you that vanguard is kicking you off the ladder, pushing you down rungs on the ladder rather than creating an environment where you can continue to climb. That's what's happening. And that's what inflation does. Matt in South Bend, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer. Hey, Matt.
Hey, Matt. Are you there, Matt?
Matt in South Bend.
Going once. Going twice.
Okay, we'll try again. One op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. Interesting. Suggestion, especially considering the source coming from a conservation perspective. This from Christopher Barnard, who is the National Policy Director for the American Conservation Coalition. He writes, the administration will have an opportunity to change course in June. In June, the Interior Department's five-year offshore oil and gas lease program will expire, putting the nation's future economy and security at risk. The administration should renew the Interior's leasing plan if it's serious about lowering energy prices and decoupling from Russian energy. Many Gulf states, such as Texas and Louisiana, rely on the economic benefits of offshore oil and gas production. It supports about 370,000 jobs, billions in tax revenue, of course. The offshore leasing program directly supplies 15% of domestic crude and 2% of natural gas, which are crucial in displacing the 670,000 barrels of oil we were importing from Russia until the ban was imposed, to be replaced by 1 million barrels a day from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. But that's not making a dent. We consume 20 million gallons of oil a day in this country. But Barnard goes on to say, as an environmentalist, I have another concern. The leasing program is a vital source of conservation funding through the Land and Water Conservation Fund. This was enacted by Congress in 64, protecting public lands, improving recreational opportunities, supporting wildlife refuges, funding pro-environment activities. This doesn't use taxpayer dollars. It relies on essentially user fees, money from the offshore oil and gas leasing. If the U.S. goes without offshore leasing for the next 5 years, the government will lose about $1.5 billion in revenue, and the grants that revenue funds to state and local governments in the interest of conservation will go with it. So another moment coming around next month for this administration as it pertains to the country's energy policy, as they've gone back and forth with suspension of leasing, reanimation of leasing. So now you've got this Interior Department five-year leasing deal that is up in June. And what will the Biden administration do about it? That's a question you might be asking your Congress beings. Tom in Blue Island, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, Dan and Amy, in the long line of if President Trump were in office, imagine the meltdown the media would be having at every press briefing if gas was $6-7 an hour and Trump put a clueless energy secretary up there like Jennifer Granholm and told everybody to buy electric cars.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's just so dismissive of, you know, people that are in need right now and that are suffering. Like, if you're on a fixed budget right now, you're screwed. You got to get a second or a third job. There's just no other way around it. Because you go to the grocery store, I swear to God, I'm going to have a heart attack. That's where I'm going down, Dan, in the produce aisle. Okay? Just giving you a heads up. Because things that were $1.99 are now $3.75. Rice that was $1.99, now it's $4.50. I mean, the type of rice that we buy. But, there's no end in sight.
It's
and
really
with gas prices
up.
Going up and diesel prices going up, it's going to cost even more because they're going to have to pass that cost on to the consumers.
It's really screwing up all those prices right games too.
Because you
can't keep track. You have stable prices with respect to groceries, and now
Think about that. Those poor people on that show. I mean, how are they going to do it?
Yeah, Drew Carey's had to do a little extra work lately. This was the conversation we've had previously. When you hear from farmers like a farmer who appeared on Tucker Carlson's show several weeks back and said, this is when gas was still hovering around $4 and now we're, you know, into $5 and $6 that we're looking at. But he said, you know, a couple hundred bucks a month in gas. No, that's a real hit. I understand that. But with the cost of fertilizer and the shortages, think about paying $1,000 more a month for the groceries you're used to buying.
Mm-hmm.
Matt in South Bend.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Got somehow hung up before, but anyways, just want to make mention, I do commute to the region in Hobart, Indiana. I've done it for the last 11 years. That's 1 month of driving back and forth over a year, and the gas prices are just eating me up. I'm growing vegetables at home and listening to your show, and you guys keep me on the straight and narrow. So I want to thank you, especially for the last episode on mental illness.
Thanks for the call, Matt. Appreciate it. Jim, St. Joe, Michigan.
Yes, good morning. Enjoy your show. I've lived out in Wyoming for about 20 years in the oil industry. I didn't work in it, but we have more oil out there and in the Dakotas than anywhere else. And this is putting a strain. And I've been reading a book by Michael Schellenberger, and I'm sure you've heard of him and know of him. He's a big environmentalist. But boy, does he have common sense. And he says wind power costs too much to even get those things started. They have to be shut down in high wind. Now they complain that they're killing the eagles out there. But he's a big advocate of nuclear energy and the use of fossil fuels. And I just got done reading a lot of information on
one of his chapters on how much CO2 levels are really low in this country now, and we're actually the cleanest country in the world. And this administration, they're just clueless, but they only have one thing in mind. They're leftist fascists, and they don't care about the everyday people. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks, Jim. Schellenberger's latest book, San Francisco, is worth checking out. Ooh. And by the way, Schellenberger is running for governor in California as an independent against Gavin Newsom. Really interesting, given that his career is as an environmentalist and a man of the left, and he's only really come over in the last couple of years to offer mea culpa on participating in so much of the climate and environmental alarmism and setting the record straight, as he has done in his last couple of books, including San Francisco, which Jim was referring to. But that's a good book to check out. And Schellenberger, that's an interesting candidacy in California. Susie on the north side.
Good morning. I feel that everything that they're doing with raising crime, prices, everything is all about their New World Order agenda, Klaus Schwab 2030. Thank you.
Thanks, Susie. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Deep thoughts from Taylor Swift. She was the commencement speaker for NYU's graduating class.
Yeah, she never graduated college herself, so.
Among other nuggets she offered the graduates, getting canceled on the internet and nearly losing my career gave me an excellent knowledge of all the types of wine. First of all, the idea that she nearly lost her career, I guess she's referring to the feud she had with Kanye West, half a dozen years ago. Somebody worth, I don't know, hundreds of millions of dollars at that time and almost losing her career, laughable. When people get victimized by cancel culture, most of them do what Taylor Swift did, which is to sort of become an amateur sommelier.
Well, you got to be you have to be a victim. Everyone's got to be a victim.
Uh-huh.
Even the richest of the rich, Dan.
Taylor Swift also imploring the graduates to decide what's yours to hold and let the rest go.
Hmm. Did she also say pass on grass is what I need to know?
She said learn to live alongside cringe. No matter how hard you try to avoid being cringe, you will look back on your life and cringe retrospectively. Cringe is unavoidable over a lifetime. Oh, you mean like that haircut you had when you were in college versus 20 years later? Sure. Yeah. You know, I think she's actually the perfect commencement speaker. It's the best choice I've seen from a prestige university, prestige in quotes, like NYU, to demonstrate how unserious those prestige, in quote, universities are. The only better choice that I've seen
is
Jacinda Ardern, the authoritarian prime minister of New Zealand, COVIDian lockdown extraordinaire. She's giving the commencement at Harvard. And that's even better because that demonstrates those same prestige, in quotes, universities' commitment to authoritarianism by having somebody like Ardern lecture us on pandemic policy, ostensibly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good stuff. For more on commencement speakers and the state of college campuses, as if it's not obvious, pleased to be joined by Scott Walker, former governor of Wisconsin, now the president of Young America's Foundation. Scott, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning. Great to be with you.
So Taylor Swift, Jacinda Ardern, center cut for higher education these days.
Yeah, it is unbelievable. In fact, it's interesting. We've done for 30 years at Young America's Foundation
we've done a survey of the, according to the U.S. News and World Report, the top 100 national universities. And not shockingly, per the two examples you gave, out of those top 100, you know how many had conservative speakers? Three.
That's it.
Three, and actually two of the three were more because of just who they are and how they're connected. One was Virginia Tech, who had the relatively new governor there in Virginia, Glenn Youngkin, and the other was Florida, of course, who had former NFL and college great quarterback Tim Tebow, who is obviously iconic in Florida, having brought them a national championship. But only three of the 100 could somehow find a conservative commencement speaker, while others got great words of insight from people like Taylor Swift.
Governor Walker, who was the third?
The Greek prime minister. So you really had to go around the world for them to find somebody else. And again, in that case, I think it was more about the connection to Greece than really about his politics. But the you know, all the rest were just, as you mentioned, the prime minister of New Zealand. You've got Dwayne Wade. You've got all these other folks talking about Deval Patrick, the former Democrat governor of Massachusetts.
That's a real get. Smith,
Powell. Yeah. You've got these long list of radicals. But I guess it really shouldn't surprise folks, because that is the state of our country and of really the canary in the coal mine, which is our colleges and universities.
Well, if you were a conservative, you wouldn't even want to be invited, because you're just going there to get pilloried and booed, like happened to Wyoming Senator Cynthia Lummis when she gave the commencement at University of Wyoming, and she made the offensive remark that there are two biological sexes.
It's really remarkable. You get that?
Yeah.
We saw that when Mike Pence was vice president, and the pushback he got there. You know, no sense of, hey, maybe we go to college to think critically, to be open to different ideas, to examine our own beliefs. No, and that's pretty consistent. You've seen similar surveys of college faculty, for example, and we've known for decades they're left of center. One of the surveys I remember did just a comparison of registrations, and I don't even think this fully encapsulates that, because it's just Democrat and Republican. We all know that on college campuses there are those who are far left than just traditional Democrats. But in 1999, that ratio was about 4.5 to 1. 20 years later, it had gone to about 10 to 1. And today it's probably more like 20 to 1. And again, that doesn't even reflect the most radical of extremists on the campus. And they wonder why, you know, we question more and more and more. I've often said this past year, we would do more in America to stop the spread of communism than to stop the spread of COVID if we closed our colleges and universities down again. It's funny, but it's sadly become increasingly a reality.
Yeah. And I know the Disinformation Governance Board is on hiatus, so we hear yesterday. But that doesn't mean the disinformation officers on college campuses are not continuing their work. University of Illinois Chicago School of Public Health has published a health brief entitled Addressing Weight Stigma and Fat Phobia in Public Health. They want to ban the word obesity on campus because focusing on body size is rooted in racism, they say, and that's certainly good news to Governor Pritzker.
It's a medical term.
Well, the crazy part about it is, so yet some of the same people were talking about high risk factors earlier in the pandemic, of which obesity is one of them, mm-hmm. Diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure, all those sorts of things that were, and age, of course, that were factors for people in terms of not only whether they got COVID or not, but how likely it was to cause serious damage or even lead to death. They're conflicting, you know. It's you know, anybody can be a woman, except when we're talking abortion, and then it's only a woman's issue. It's not a women and men. I mean, it's hard to keep track of their contradictions. But this is, we've said this for years, that if it wasn't for double standards, the left would have no standards at all, and it's incredibly frustrating. The other thing that was amazing when you mentioned Swift's comments, this idea of the cancel culture, that Kanye West grabbing the mic somehow was cancel culture.
Everyone's got to be a victim.
Yeah, it helped rocket herself.
to even greater notoriety. Cancel culture is when a just middle of the road to right leaning, right of center leaning student speaker or dare I say occasionally, there aren't many, but maybe even an educator dares to actually say something that isn't radical and they get shut down. That's cancel culture. And we see it all the time in our colleges and universities, increasingly even in our schools, which is why I'm at Young America's Foundation, because we're trying to counter that.
Now, where's the big guy going to be speaking, President Biden? Is he have anything
Delaware.
On the docket? Oh, going home.
You know, probably projected right from his basement, I guess. But he doesn't go much between Washington, D.C. and Delaware. But and I can only imagine what the teleprompter will be speaking there. But it's just incredibly frustrating because you've got – we just last month in April, we invaded college campuses. We had almost 30 different speakers on the lecture circuit. But even for those, we many cases have to go to court. We have to file lawsuits. We have to take action just to get right of center voices on campus. You know, free speech is something that's guaranteed in our Constitution, but it should be revered on our college campuses. And oftentimes that's where it's the most at risk, which is why we're pushing back.
Where's Hunter Biden speaking? Is he going to do Georgetown where he did his undergrad or Yale where he got his law degree? Do you know?
Yeah. Well, that's a good example of a campus. I know on the survey of faculty, I think they're literally, they couldn't find a one in the survey who was registered as a Republican. Not shockingly, there, you know, places like that, George Washington University, a lot of these Washington-based folks, it's just a question of, you know, which party are you a Democrat or you're a radical socialist? Increasingly, that's blurring the line, and that's what our college students are up against these days.
I got an idea for a scholarship program in Young America's Foundation, and I can't fund it myself, but I'm willing to help if this is of interest. I mean, maybe you even have something like this. But it's sparked my thinking on it from this piece by Michael Anton. And he's talking about where are the Tom Wolfes of our generation penning novels like Radical Chic and Bonfire of the Vanities. He writes, you know, in his writings, Wolfe was amazed and fascinated by the riotous spectacle of New York high society, which was memorialized in Radical Chic, of course, and that it hadn't produced until Radical Chic any big realistic novel in the vein of Dickens or Twain. He similarly asked earlier in the 60s, where are the novels about hippies? What the storytelling that needs to be done to drive home the point, much more popular than these sort of political and policy tomes. And so he poses the same question today. Where are the send-ups of wokeness, of big tech, of the global elite, of deep state apparatchiks? Where are the sympathetic accounts of the deplorables in novel form? And I'm wondering if you don't think it might be a good idea to encourage through opportunities young people, you know, Tom Wolfe obviously is a rare talent, but young people who are aspiring writers and show some promise to pursue being a novelist, a cultural commentator, the way that Wolfe was, for example, to inform culture and thinking about our society the way that Wolfe did.
You know, that's a fascinating idea. I mean, we have a National Journalism Center of which people like Greg Gutfield are alums. In fact, actually speaking of great writers, Peter Schweitzer, who's got the great book Red Handed these days, is another one of our alums at Young America's Foundation. But those aren't novelists. That's an interesting concept. We teach them to be good investigative reporters because that's about the only way someone who's right of center can make a play these days is to actually investigate things, look into the spending or absurdity. I can't imagine, though, a novel that would create a more graphic image of life than what Hunter Biden has done himself. But yeah, that would be an interesting concept to have that out there for sure.
Yeah,
I mean, you guys workshopping ideas right now. I love
I mean, it's the Black Panther fundraiser at Leonard Bernstein's penthouse in Manhattan. I mean, and you're right. All you have to really do is document what is and put it in novel form and storytelling form. I think, you know, we talk about this. We talk about, you know, Andrew Clavin. We talk about this all the time. You know, where are the conservatives who are in the arts and entertainment producing quality product that that gets beyond, you know, the center right echo chamber. I think that's a legitimate question.
And they're under attack as well. I years ago, I spoke at something called Friends of Abe, which is this secret society, if you will, of people in Hollywood. A few of them, of which have made themselves public, Gary Sinise, John Voight, voices like that. But most of the rest had to show up, and you literally, to speak, had to agree that you would not reveal names because they were producers and actors and stagehands and others that were there. And that's the kind of abuse that they get in Hollywood, which probably is a reminder that Hollywood, the West Coast and the East Coast, the coastal elites, certainly don't reflect most of the rest of society. But with Hunter, I was just this last weekend. One of the things YF has is we own and operate the Reagan Ranch outside of Santa Barbara, California. And we were up there with a group touring the place where President Reagan lived when he was president, other than the White House. And it's amazing because we pointed out that there was a helipad where Marine One would land. And when he was done being president, he made them take the helipad out. And the reason was he didn't want to benefit post-presidency from someday selling his ranch and having a helipad up there because it was paid for by the taxpayers. And how Mike Reagan, who I saw on Saturday, his son, said that it used to frustrate him that his dad wouldn't talk business with him, but he didn't want his sons or his children to benefit from their connection to their father. What a stark contrast to the Bidens these days. It's just remarkable.
Yeah. Well, and just on the Tom Wolfe thing too. It's, you know, you don't have to necessarily lead with the label. I mean, the way that John Milius didn't lead with that label for most of his career as a screenwriter and director, but he produced. I mean, he directed Red Dawn, and obviously he co-wrote Apocalypse Now. So you'll let the work product speak for itself, and like Tom Wolfe did, who never really identified as a conservative or Republican, and you know the stories win the day. You know, to the extent that they're salient and well crafted. Just a
like
thought.
It.
But I mean, yeah, the Reagan. I love the Reagan story. I didn't know that story about the helipad. That's great.
In a while. Yeah, he just adamantly didn't want to, even in the barn where they skipped their hay, there was two different piles, one for his horses and one for the Secret Services, because he didn't want his horses eating hay paid for by the taxpayers. It's just a remarkable contrast to what we see today.
Talks speaks about his character.
I wonder if Hillary separates the hay at Chappaqua from the taxpayer hay versus the...
She's taking everything she can get and some.
Yeah.
Scott Walker, former governor of Wisconsin, now the president of Young America's Foundation. Scott, thanks for joining us as always. Appreciate it.
Our pleasure. Have a great day.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Jason Riley writing in the Wall Street Journal about the massacre in Buffalo over the weekend. It's unfortunate that this is what it takes for Buffalo to get the attention it deserves because the city has been hurting for decades. Its population peaked in 1950 and has been falling steadily since the 1970s. Today, this former industrial powerhouse is the third poorest city of its size in the country, with more than one in three residents on food stamps. Three quarters of the city's public school children qualify for free or reduced price lunches. Between 2019 and 2020, while murders rose 30% nationwide, they rose 34% in Buffalo. And while the actions of a self-described white supremacist have put Buffalo in the news, the city's problem is hardly white supremacy. Buffalo has a black mayor who is serving his fifth consecutive four-year term. The leader of the city council and the school superintendent are also black, as is the man who served as police commissioner from 2018 until his retirement earlier this year. Like other cities in previous eras, Coleman Young's Detroit, Marion Barry's Washington, Sharp James's Newark, Buffalo's black underclass has gotten poorer under the direction of black politicians. Electing people who share your race or ethnicity is no guarantee that they will act in your best interests. Oh, really? Tell us about more about that, Chicago, with Lori Lightfoot and Kim Fox and Tony Preckwinkle and Tim Evans as the chief judge. And we could go on. Kwame Raoul as the attorney general. How's it going for black families in Chicago and Illinois? For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Tom Rogan, who is a former federal prosecutor and recently penned a piece at City Journal, The 5 Worst Prosecutors in America. That is tough to rank. There's a lot of competition. Yeah. He also served as a local prosecutor and an elected DA. Tom Hogan, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Pleasure to be on.
The context that Riley provides to Buffalo is sort of important because it's really the situation in so many major urban areas around the country. And because politicians have given up trying to address the systemic problems in these cities, they demagogue things like gun ownership or race, as we're seeing from the left in the wake of that that atrocity in Buffalo over the weekend.
It doesn't have to be that way. Folks don't have to vote just based on race. But at the same time, you've got plenty of black prosecutors that are very good. Kim Worthy in Detroit, who is facing a lot of poverty and a lot of problems, is doing a fantastic job because she upholds the law and she goes after violent criminals hard. I would suggest that your state's attorney, Kim Fox, who made that list of the 5 worst prosecutors, maybe ought to look to Kim Worthy in Detroit and see how a real prosecutor deals with real problems.
Well, what is the number one grievance you have against Kim Fox? Because I'm sure there's a lot.
Yeah, the problem with this piece of limiting it to just 5 of the worst prosecutors is that there were a lot of candidates. But Kim Fox, if you look at her record, first of all, we always look to see how is violence doing in any place where someone is the chief prosecutor. You guys are obviously experiencing a tremendous spike in homicides and shootings. And you know, prosecutors like to claim credit when crime goes down. Well, they have to take some blame when crime goes up. And Kim Fox's de-prosecution strategies, her refusal to prosecute certain crimes, her refusal to sentence hard, is one of the main reasons that she makes the list. Now, you add in the things like Jussie Smollett and her refusal to prosecute there, just based on race, really. And politics, and then her decision that the gang shootout was mutual combat and that nobody should be charged with that, that's basically devolving Chicago into the Wild West. So there are a lot of different reasons that you would pick Kim Fox for this list, but those are 3 right off the bat.
Well, you mentioned Kim Worthy in Detroit. So let's point to the outliers, the prosecutors, I should say, and the police chiefs who are serious about quelling violent crime. You also had a police chief that recently retired in Detroit, James Craig, now running for governor, again, a black gentleman, who was serious about it, too. So the difference between Detroit, where you had a police chief and you have a prosecutor that are serious, as you were describing the prosecutor, versus where you have a David Brown, who's a toady of a Lori Lightfoot, who is a non-prosecution decarceration advocate, combined with Kim Fox, and then you have lawlessness and not even an effort to really control it, just an effort to spin it.
Absolutely. And what Chicago has to worry about is that they're going to Detroit themselves, because Detroit did go through this period where both the mayor, the police chief, and the chief prosecutor all sort of went out to lunch on crime. And Detroit went from being one of the largest cities in the United States to down to 600,000. It was once on par with Philadelphia and Chicago in terms of size and industry and business. But eventually, everyone fled. And Chicago is facing that same sort of problem. Unless they elect people who are actually going to take care of the problems. Detroit came out on the other side and now is starting to elect people like Kim Worthy, who are, and like the gentleman who is now running for governor in Michigan. And now those folks, regardless of their race, are starting to address these problems. It may be too late for Detroit. We all hope it's not too late for Chicago.
What do you think of electronic monitoring programs? I mean, we also have the combination of the prosecutor and the chief judge I mentioned in Cook County, a chief judge who doesn't believe that anyone under the age of 25 has the mental capacity to be held responsible for criminal activity. It's a remarkable statement, but it's one he's made several times, basically, really.
Yeah, and he wanted a 19-year-old who fatally shot an 8-year-old to go to counseling.
And so you have that situation. So electronic monitoring, we had last year 5 dozen violent offenders who were accused of a violent crime. They were arrested for a violent crime. They were waiting trial out on electronic monitoring where they, while on electronic monitoring, killed or attempted to kill another person. Mm-hmm. And so one wonders, is this a problem with the monitoring or is it a problem with putting violent offenders on monitoring or some combination of the two?
Well, you've got two problems mixed up in there. One is that the violent criminals can't be released pending trial. That has been proven over and over again. New York is experiencing the same thing. Philadelphia is experiencing the same thing. If you have somebody who's a danger to the community, then they should not be out on the street. They should be in jail awaiting trial. The other one is this idea of people under the age of 25 not understanding what they're doing and not being held criminally responsible. That runs smack into what academia calls the age crime curve, which is the major age for violent crime in the United States is 65. And now people are telling us that a big chunk of them, specifically the adults in that cohort, the 18 to 25-year-olds, can't be held responsible for their criminal activities. That's ridiculous. You are now saying you are going to set free the most violent cohort in the United States. It's also very contrary to common sense. You guys, think back to when you were 18, 19, 20. Did you know that it wasn't okay to shoot and kill somebody?
Yes.
Of course you did. And the cohort that actually is doing this in that 18 to 25-year-old range, very small. It's less than 5% of offenders. So it's not that everybody who's under the age of 25 doesn't understand what they're doing. It's a very small percentage of people. They're easy to identify, and they are different from your average person.
Well, it seems like such a simple solution to not let carjackers, rapists, armed robbers out on electronic monitoring, but yet they do it. Currently, we have about close to 90 people right now who are violent offenders who are on electronic monitoring. Do you know the totals of any other cities like Philadelphia or San Francisco or New York, how many they have out on electronic monitoring?
Oh, New York has hundreds. And they are tracking all the ones who are engaged in violent crime. And sometimes they're not even on monitoring. They simply are set free without any bail. And they are now tracking how many of them are engaged in violent crime while they were set free. So it is a major problem. And think about it. You're a violent criminal. You shot somebody, you killed them, or you badly injured them, or you raped somebody, you know that you're going to jail for, well, the traditional prosecutor, 10, 20 years life. With Kim Fox, you might be going to jail for a few months. But electronic home monitoring, all you're going to do is cut the monitor and leave. I mean, that's the least of your worries considering the offense that you committed.
Oh, these 5 worst prosecutors in America that you ranked, is there anything that separates one from the other, or is it the same sort of dynamics that we are experiencing in Chicago with Kim Fox?
You see common elements to all of them along with Kim Fox. You see relative inexperience. You see politicization of criminal law. You're seeing refusing to prosecute entire categories of crimes, refusing to differentiate between violent criminals and, you know, lesser crimes and just treating everybody leniently. And you're seeing ambition and arrogance. Kim Fox, she clearly sees herself doing something else in the future. And she is arrogating these powers from everybody else. She's going to decide who gets prosecuted when, regardless of what the law says. And that is a recipe for disaster.
Speaking of mayors, and we'll speak of ours in Chicago. So when there was a young man involved and was killed in a police-involved shooting because he had a gun and it turned to the officer, and so the officer shot him. Lori Lightfoot said that it's time to rethink foot chases by police. The other week, we had a young man, a 23-year-old culinary student, who was shot for his cell phone. Thankfully, he looks like he's going to survive. He's off life support, incredibly, because he was shot point blank in the head, but it looks like he's going to survive.
Too.
What we find out subsequently is that the person who's been arrested for that crime had stolen a car, was in a police chase. The police stopped giving chase, and he ultimately wound up in Lincoln Park lying in wait for this kid who he shot and irreparably harmed. And so on police chases and when mayors announce to the world that we need to rethink foot chases by police, when the essential order is don't give chase when a vehicle to vehicle chase either. What's your reaction to those sorts of pronouncements and the impact on controlling crime, public safety?
That's the old hard cases make bad law and bad rulings. You have one or two bad incidents in a chase, and the next thing you know, they're outlawing chases. The first people that find out that a police department is no longer allowed to chase are the police. The second person are the bad guys.
Yep.
I actually was speaking to a group of bad guys from North Philly, which is the equivalent of the south side of Chicago. And I asked them about the Philly police pursuit policy, which, just like Chicago, pretty much has been outlawed, both foot and car. And they said, look, we know darn well the police can't chase us anymore. So no matter what we're up to, no matter what we're doing, we run. We take off on foot. We take off on our cars. It doesn't matter. We know the police can't catch us, and they're not going to. So back in the old days when police were allowed to chase, half the time guys knew there wasn't any use in running, and they would just give themselves up. The other half the time there would be a chase, and they would get run down, and they would get charged with resisting arrest or attempting escape as well on top of their other charges, making their life a little bit harder. That's simply not true anymore, and that signal to the streets is we're not enforcing the law, and you can get away with whatever you want. You send that signal to the streets, bad guys understand that signal loud and clear, and will react accordingly by breaking the law and doing what they want.
He is Tom Hogan, served as a federal prosecutor, local prosecutor, and elected DA. He's currently in private practice. Tom, thanks as always. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Good luck to Chicago. Hang in there.
We'll need
Thanks.
It.
Yeah. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's morning answer on AM 560. The answer. This is Chicago's morning answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, with the market taking biggest one-day hit since June of 2020, combined with words like stagflation and recession being thrown around. Reaction from the White House was solicited yesterday, and this is what Biden spokesman Karine Jean-Pierre had to say.
The Fed chair, the Federal Reserve is independent. We leave them to make their own policy decisions. We do not get involved in that. And nothing has changed on how we see the stock market. That's not something that we keep an eye on every day.
What?
I'm not going to comment about that from here.
It's not something we keep an eye on every day?
Yeah.
What are her priorities? What is she? Oh, I know it's her first week on the job, but get it together, girl.
A lot of other people are keeping an eye on the market on a daily basis. Not that there's anything policy-wise I expect the administration to do about it, but dismissal doesn't really play well. In addition to that, when it comes to shortages, on the one hand, you have the president invoking the Defense Production Act to employ commercial airlines to import baby formula or to bring baby formula from overseas to this country. On the other hand, you have White House guidance that suggests that moms try to get free samples from their doctors as a way to address baby formula that they otherwise can't obtain right now.
I have two new moms on my street. The problem is that's tapped out. That reserve is gone. So now where do they turn? And again, we mentioned that yesterday. Two babies in Memphis, Tennessee had to go to the hospital and put on IV because their parents ran out of baby formula.
And the question becomes, with all of these policy challenges, to be generous, is this impotence or a lack of political willpower? For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Milton Esrati, contributing editor at National Interest, regular to City Journal and Forbes, author of 30 Tomorrows, the Next Three Decades of Globalization, Demographics, and How We Will Live. Milton Esrati, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So what about that with respect to curbing inflation, with respect to addressing supply chain issues and associated shortages? Is this just the tools are not available, or is this a political willpower problem inside the Beltway?
A little of both, or maybe a lot of both, would be to put it. The administration could sweep away some of the red tape involved in getting things from Europe. The FDA said we can't import the European stuff for a long time. The shelves emptied. They could have done this months ago. Indeed, the news on what was happening with baby formula was really appeared in last year in November, and there was enormous delays. They could have cleared the decks for this long before now. So in that sense, policy could have eased this problem tremendously.
And so where do we find ourselves with respect to the title of a recent piece you penned over at American Mind, a stagflation? Is that is your suggestion is that we're entering a period of stagflation, even as the market analysts debate whether recession comes this year or next?
Well, stagflation is tied to recession, and I would say that a period of stagflation and recession are right now virtually inevitable. There is no way to avoid it. We could have if the Fed and the administration had acted a year ago, a little over a year ago, when we first saw signs of inflation. If they had acted then promptly, we could have been on track for a soft landing. But now that water's over the dam. There is very little that can be done to avoid a recession. I'm not talking about something as severe as 2008, 2009. That was a special case. But recession and stagflation, as I say, they're tied. They're joined at the hip.
Do you feel like you're reliving the early 80s and late 70s all over again?
I feel like I'm reliving the late 70s, and yes, indeed, we have inflation here. The inflation is fundamental. It is not a supply shortage problem. It is misguided policies over a long period of time in which the Fed financed deficit spending in Washington. And that is the fundamental cause of this inflation. It ain't going away fast. Even if we could rid ourselves of supply chain problems tomorrow, we would still face some inflationary pressure, indeed a great deal of inflationary pressure. And that's why I say by now the recession is inevitable, the stagflation is inevitable.
You wrote a book that tackles the topic of globalization, among other topics. What are the lessons that you take away from the push for globalization between 1990 and 2010?
Well, the globalization effectively replace the American working man with cheap labor overseas. It's the way the market works, and I'm not excusing it for that. Policies could have been put in place, and the companies that went overseas now are should have been more long-term in their thinking, because now they're paying a price in that we have shortages and they have shortages, and they have to bring this home, if not for the sake of the American worker, for the sake of control. And that was the big mistake of the globalization. It was a movement to get cheap labor at any cost, and they sacrificed their long-term company prospects in order to do that.
And so do you see that some of the what's being promoted as America First policies, but also embraced by some elements of, you know, the center left, or really even just the left, including trade unions, as the course correction? Is that the course correction?
Well, I think the unions have their own interests involved here. I think there is a course. There is a course correction taking place here. It's not done out of altruism, and it's not done for the reasons the unions are saying. I think it's being done by corporations who realize that China and some of these overseas locations are not as reliable as they previously thought, and they have to find other supply solutions. Part of which is bringing some of this home.
And one of, you know, Michael Lind has an interesting piece in Tablet, Michael Lind from University of Texas, Austin, and he talks about sort of the three huge policy areas that the political elites in both parties got wrong over the last 30 years. One we just mentioned, globalization, and he uses NAFTA as sort of a jumping off point to make that argument similar to what you just made. In addition, in the post-Soviet Russia era, the push by neocons of the Bill Kristol sort to extend Pax Americana globally and export, you know, our model of governance globally. Is that something else that requires a course correction, even as we're, you know, underwriting the Ukrainian effort to repel Russia and really haven't, despite Trump's four-year interregnum, in terms of the elites in D.C. still have an sort of an internationalist bent?
Yeah, I think the elite remains very internationalist. And what upsets me, although I'm an economist, not a foreign affairs kind of guy, is there is too much moralism and too little realism. It is impossible that the United States can promote moral purity and democracy around the world. We don't even have it at home, but can promote it around the world. I think we need to think in terms of national interests first and the right things to do from a moral point of view second. But as I say, I'm an economist, not a foreign affairs kind of guy.
Do you think President Trump, if he was in office right now, we'd be dealing with stagflation?
I think he would be trying. Although Trump, and I'm not here to praise or blame Trump, he leaned on the Fed to finance his own deficits. So he had a political agenda, and what I would describe as a short-term political agenda that dominated him. I think Biden's doing nothing. Trump might have changed course because he was much more of a realist about the state of the economy. But what he was doing was actually feeding the inflation monster before the fact. But he insisted that the Fed bring rates down. Jerome Powell finally bowed to that and brought rates down in 2019, even before the pandemic. And that helped finance the Trump tax cuts. They probably would have financed themselves in the long term, but Trump wanted it immediately, and the Fed bowed. And that was the pattern that had been going on since Obama.
What's your reaction to the position taken by the likes of Larry Summers that one thing you can do is increase taxes to shut down production or disincentivize production to reduce demand?
Well, it would do that. It would reduce demand. It would also reduce supply. It would,
yes.
Because if you shut down production and you shut down business by raising taxes, they wouldn't produce the, what, to sound poetic, the sinews of the abilities, the sinews of the economy to produce. So I think it would be a short-term solution. You'd reduce demand. That would take some of the pressure off prices, but you would also be paving the way for a long-term problem, a supply shortage. Inflation is a monetary phenomenon. The Fed has to correct what it's been doing. It has been pumping money into this economy. It has to withdraw that liquidity. It will create a recession, but it has to do this. Otherwise, we retain this inflationary pressure.
And if you couple that with tax increases, that deepens the recession. Is that fair?
You bet. That deepens the recession. Well said.
Milton Esrati, contributing editor at National Interest, regular City Journal and Forbes, author of 30 Tomorrows, The Next Three Decades of Globalization, Demographics, and How We Will Live. Milton Esrati, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and Amy, this disturbing video that's circulating thanks to libs of TikTok.
It's something that you see and you can never unsee.
This is a mother in the dressing room with her young son. And remember, these are videos that
they post,
and libs of TikTok just repurposes for distribution. Take a listen.
It seems harder and harder to ignore that the...
Okay, hold on. You love it, and you want it, and you picked it out, but you don't want it for school. Can you tell me why?
Because last time I wore a dress to school, everybody called me a girl.
Oh. Well, what did we learn from My Shadow is Pink?
Even when you wear a dress, you're not a girl.
What makes a shirt for a boy or a girl?
Nothing.
So do you want this? You picked it out.
Pointing to the dress.
You want to wear it all the time at home, but not at school, right?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
I don't want to get made fun of, and that's what they always do when I wear pink stuff.
I'm sorry,
but
baby.
Not when I do it only on special occasions.
What makes you like dresses so much?
I just like dresses.
Hmm. Do you think bright, pretty colors and dresses and sequins and jewels and golds, all the things that you always want to wear,
mm-hmm.
do you think that's your innermost you?
Mm-hmm. It is.
Well, how are you going to be your innermost you when we live in a place that people think clothing belongs to a particular gender? It's a trick, isn't it? You know, your mommy gets made fun of by people for looking like this, too.
Huh?
Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
Nope. Mm-hmm. That's just wrong.
You, right? Do you remember Jeffrey Marsh?
Jeffrey Marsh? Who's Jeffrey Marsh?
Jeffrey Marsh is one of the most beautiful people. Remember, they were born a boy, but they know that they're just them.
Mm-hmm.
What about Ty?
She's a girl.
They get made fun of sometimes too, ma'am. I guess you just have to decide if being you is the most important part of you.
Let's go.
Okay, let's go.
Oh, clearly a mother in trying to indoctrinate her child. There's so much wrong with this. I don't know where to start.
The beginning. Minneapolis-based World Professional Association for Transgender Health publishes a Standards of Care for the Health of Transsexual, Transgender, and Gender Nonconforming People. Mm-hmm. It's a document that a lot of physicians use to guide their treatment of those identifying as transgender. Currently undergoing its seventh revision, with a draft version of the eighth edition of the standard of care having recently been released. One of the sources the group, this Minneapolis-based group that medical professionals use to inform their treatment, one of the sources the group uses to guide this draft is an organization that hosts and produces fictional child pornography and sadomasochistic content. On December of 2021, the draft guidelines, which included for the first time the category of eunuch as a protected gender identity, WPATH's updated 8th edition of their standards of care recommends medical treatment and services for those with a self-declared gender identity, describes the relationship between eunuch-identified people and other transgender people, claiming that eunuch-identified people may suffer the same minority stress as other stigmatized groups, and refers exclusively to research collected from a hardcore fetish site called the Eunuch Archives, which features child sexual exploitation fantasies centered around stopping little boys from going through puberty. The Eunuch Archives Fiction Archive. And it is acknowledged in this standard of care document that is put forward by this group and utilized by physicians. Eunuch Archives. This is transgenderism. This is medieval. I mean, it's literally something out of Game of Thrones. The Unsullied? Is that what we're doing now with little boys? Or aiming to do if a little boy goes through a period where he wants to try and address or likes to dress? You know, let's move to chemical castration. It's the same conversation that's previewed in the Matt Walsh film, What's a Woman, that's coming out June 1st, where he asks a doctor who uses drugs that essentially are used for chemical castration as part of the treatment for trans kids. And she cuts off the interview, at least in the trailer, so we'll see when the film comes out. How much additional detail he has to offer. This is medieval, this trans movement. Medieval lunacy. Really, really, sorry to be this graphic, but this is what it is. This is their how-to manuals, their standards of care, this sort of grooming you hear going on in that video.
Clearly, he doesn't want to wear his dress at school, but he likes to put it on at home. And
well,
you know,
dress
up. Kids play at that age. Kids play dress up all the time. They do.
The point the mom is making by posting the video obviously is the problem is he gets made fun of.
Yeah, and society's problem.
Yeah, society has the problem. It's not her that has the problem.
She's so woke.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM 560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, newly minted press spokes being Corinne Jean-Pierre, black female gay immigrant.
Because that's how she introduced herself.
Correct.
Making history.
She was asked about big guy and Reparation H's reaction to the pro-abort protesters outside the homes of Supreme Court justices. She said this.
So the president and the vice president were energized to see the many people peacefully gathering this past weekend. The administration continues to do everything possible to protect access to women's reproductive rights, including working closely with abortion rights groups, providers, and elected officials, and more. He was indeed energized to see what folks coming out peacefully protesting and speaking out.
Sally. Go ahead, Sally.
Yeah, and it's energizing. Protests like this energize the big guy in Reparation H.
The church, the state, you can't make us procreate. The church, the state, you can't make us procreate. The church, the
F the church, F the state, you can't make us procreate. That's what energizes, the sort of thing that energizes Biden and Harris. It's impressive. There was a committee hearing yesterday on the topic of abortion services.
I heard.
And
how did that go?
Very telling exchanges between members of Congress and those testifying. First, we've got Representative Mike Johnson, Republican from Louisiana, questioning a pro-abort activist named Amy Arambide, who's from Texas, and just trying to sort of essentially get to the question without asking it explicitly, when do protections for children attach?
So abortion should be allowed then, by your definition, for any reason, for any purpose, at any stage, right?
I trust people to make decisions about their body, and then when relevant, I think that they need to consult their medical practitioners.
Okay.
And not Congress.
If it is, listen, let me just ask you this question. If it is not lawful and morally acceptable to take the life of a 10-year-old child, I assume you agree with that, right? That would be wrong, correct?
I believe that.
Okay.
That is
and
wrong.
A 2-year-old child, same thing. That would be murder. We would all agree that's wrong. Then what is the principal distinction between the human being that is 2 years old or 9 months old or 1 week old or an hour old than one that is 8 inches further up the birth canal in the utero? What's the difference? Why is it okay in the latter case and not the former cases?
I trust people to determine what to do with their own bodies.
Wow.
Full stop.
Full stop. Yeah.
It's like a Democratic talking point now. Lightfoot says it every day. Equity and full stop.
Well, right, because they can't get into the actual question that was posed. They won't answer the when does life begin because they know that is a concession, whatever they say, that that is a person then and that rights are attached. And so infanticide is not justified. They can't be formally pro-infanticide. So they have to couch it in the I trust people to make decisions with their body language. Birthing people, by the way, not women. Birthing people,
of
course.
Oh, that's what they use, of course, yeah.
Another exchange that was illuminating, this going the other direction now, Congressman Jamie Raskin, who is one of the most reprehensible members of Congress, one of the most disingenuous, smarmy, and slimy members of Congress, Democrat Socialist from Maryland, questioning, or first of all, characterizing the position of Catherine Glenn Foster, who's the president of Americans United for Life, before asking for her comment and then getting just very nicely offered pushback that left him befuddled the same way that that pro-abort activist from Texas was befuddled by Mike Johnson's questioning. Take a listen.
They called is candidly and openly calling for a nationwide ban on all abortions with no exceptions for rape or incest. And if I've got that wrong, I would invite Ms. Foster to correct me. Do I have it wrong, yes or no?
If we added rape and incest exceptions, would you vote for it?
Okay, I reclaim my time, of course.
I bet you reclaim your time. I bet you reclaim your time. Answer her question. Is that what the holdup is, Jamie Raskin, the rape incest exceptions? It's a nice little piece of jujitsu from Catherine Glenn Foster because it exposes the fallaciousness of the position that pro-aborts pretend to have that is about rape and incest exceptions rather than about abortion on demand for any reason, all 9 months, and even if the baby is born, then we have a discussion per Ralph KKK Northam. That's the actual position. And it got exposed with that pro-abortion activist in questioning by Mike Johnson. And it got exposed again with Catherine Glenn Foster's response to Jamie Raskin.
312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
And one additional point on this, too, since you have all this public opinion survey research that's being bandied about. 60% of Americans don't want Roe v. Wade to be overturned. The Constitution is not the subject to a plebiscite. So the question is not where the American people are at any given point in time. I mean, it was 50-50 6 years ago. So at that point, what should we do if we're just going to be human weather vanes and accede to wherever the majority is at any given moment? Of course, that's not how a representative republic works, and it doesn't work that way because it was conceived to be more thoughtful and reflective than it actually has turned out to be in practice recently. But nonetheless, we don't just have raise your hands and the yays versus the nays win every issue. We have elected representatives. We have a constitution. We have unelected judges who interpret the constitution as it pertains to issues of law that in controversy that come before them. So the 60% who say because of the gaslighting by the media and the demagoguery of disingenuous Democrats, socialists, say, oh, well, I don't want Roe v. Wade to be overturned because for whatever reasons they say, mostly societal in nature and probably a perception of where they think the majority is. You know, unfortunately, most people are sheep, not sheepdogs. And so that is irrelevant as far as I'm concerned. And public opinion is not wholly irrelevant, but it is not determinative of where we should be when it comes to interpreting the Constitution or where we should be when it comes to legislating. You elect people, and your elected people appoint and confirm people for their judgment, not to be wherever 50% plus one is on every issue at any given moment. And that seems to be lost in this conversation where we're so sort of opinion survey obsessed. Phil, Northwest Side.
So, you know, the kids think they're well-informed. Everybody thinks they're well-informed. What needs to be done is the politicians that are involved in this, especially making money on baby parts and fetal parts and things like this, and T-cells and everything else, they should be ousted. They should be told, people should be told what kind of money they're making. You know, Planned Parenthood has been doing 30,000 abortions a week, and they always talk about rape and incest. We understand about rape and incest. In some countries, in some religions, incest is legal. But the point is, we all understand the feel-good arguments like they do in everything in politics, always for the protection of feel-good feelings. The kids and the young people are never told the realities and the numbers. And the numbers are staggering.
Yeah.
And not to mention it's all on our tax dollars. And, you know, people got to realize the devil was God's most beautiful angel. And when you deal with these satanic politicians and the Illuminati and Luciferians, they believe in the golden billion, and this is all part of it, and the feminization of men, because men have no choice. And, you know, that she wants to say, oh, it's my body, it's my choice. But what if it's his child and he wants to keep that child? You know, no men have rights in this country anymore for anything. And it's all over the excuses of that somehow all these women are raped every, 30,000 women are raped every week in this country, not to mention all the abortions we pay for on our tax dollars in other countries.
Thanks for the call, Phil. Here's the other thing, which mentioned before, keep mentioning. Tim Carney picks it up in his Washington Examiner piece. If you reduce the number of abortions, which is the ultimate aim of pro-lifers, you would increase the number of black babies and the black share of the U.S. population. Black babies, 3 times as likely as white babies to be aborted. Hispanic babies, 2x as likely as white babies to be aborted. So, identitarians, explain your position. How do you square that? Chris on the Dan Ryan.
Hey, Dan. Hey, Amy. It's a real quick question for you. Maybe you can answer it for me, Dan. Does it say in the law, and I'm not sure about every state, but doesn't it say in the law when a pregnant woman gets shot and the baby dies along with the mother, doesn't they consider it a double homicide or a double murder?
Yes, it is.
Am I incorrect at saying that?
No, you're correct.
Okay, so why can't you just throw that back at the abortion people and say, hey, we even have laws in the books that say this. What is your position on this?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. Thanks for the call, Chris. Matt in Naperville.
Tammy Duckworth wants to codify abortion in her next 6 years. That's her priority. That's what she's tweeting about. She started tweeting about that before the leak, before the Roe v. Wade leak. And so this is what they're going to focus on while we're sending money to Ukraine. And it's nonsense. It's crazy that we have 45,000 abortions every year in Illinois, but we shut the I didn't shut the economy down. Pritzker shut the economy down for 36,000 people that maybe die from COVID while we kill 45,000 every year. Which ones do we pick to keep safe? That's what I want to know.
Thanks for the call, Matt. And
if it saves one life, I mean, we heard that for the past 2.5 years.
Who knew Tammy Duckworth was a white supremacist? All these pro-aborts are white supremacists. Well, they're aligned with white supremacists. That's good enough to be labeled a white supremacist, right? You know who else is pro-abortion? White supremacist Richard Spencer. Why is he pro-abortion? Because he's a white supremacist and he doesn't want more black and Latino babies as compared to white babies. He knows the stats.
Three times as many black kids are aborted.
Tammy Duckworth, Dick Durbin, Richard Spencer, J.B. Pritzker, white supremacists. How about that? Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.